This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. I'd like to thank my colleague Celeste Headlee for sitting in for me on short notice yesterday while I was out dealing with a family emergency. And we're going to start the program today by taking a look at what's going on in Egypt. It's been more than 2 years since anti-government protests started there. Since then, the government's been replaced. A new president has been sworn in. But protests, some violent, has started again. That was sound from demonstrations this weekend in Port Said. Those were said to be in response to death sentences handed out after a soccer riot. In a few minutes, we're going to hear more about the relationship between sports and political unrest in Egypt. That's coming up. But first, NPR's Cairo bureau chief, Leila Fadel, joins us from her base in Cairo to tell us more. Leila, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What is at the root of the demonstrations that we are seeing now? And they're not just in Port Said, they're in Cairo, too.
Well, I think it's, you know, there's been just 2 years of broken promises, a lot of people feel. And so what we're seeing is sort of a groundswell of frustration. It certainly isn't all of the country, but in the middle of Cairo, in Suez, in Port Said, in Ismailia, people saying, where is the change that you promised us? Where is the employment? Where is the money? Where are those changes? And really nothing has happened. Where are those reforms? And so a lot of it comes from that, but it's certainly not 86 million people on the streets.
And, you know, to your point, we have a clip here from a man named Midhat Saad. He worked for 27 years as a tour guide, which was one of Egypt's biggest industries, right, prior to the revolution. And this is what he had to say.
Life is not easy anymore. I mean, on the contrary, actually, I would say it's worse. It's much worse now. Huge anger in the streets because of the disappointment, you know. And that created a sort of chaotic atmosphere all over the country, which in accordance, of course, affected my business. I mean, I don't know who to blame, the regime, the opposition, whatever. I don't see them caring about Egypt. People are caring about Egypt.
Could you talk a little bit more about that? What is he saying is that the more things change, the more they stay the same, that people feel that the government's not providing any results at all?
Well, I think the main point, and I think the most important thing, and sometimes we forget this, is that people don't know who to blame here. It's been 2 years, but is it the president, Mohamed Morsi, who's currently in power? Is it the bureaucratic system that really, in many ways, is still loyal to the old regime, to the former president, Hosni Mubarak? Is it this opposition who keeps saying, this is not acceptable, but really offers no alternative to the people? And so really, when you talk to people, there is the same disappointment among everybody, but everybody blames different people about why it's happened. You know, there's been no real progress, if you think about it. They went to parliamentary elections. They voted for the first time. They were so excited that parliament got dissolved by the courts. This constitutional referendum passed by 64%, but a lot of the country also not satisfied with it. Mubarak was convicted to a life sentence that was appealed. There's only two police officers currently in jail over the killing of protesters during those 18 days, some 900 people and many more since. So people are saying, where is the justice? Where is the reform? And most of all, how do we eat? How do we feed ourselves and our families?
I was also interested in what he said about the huge anger in the streets because of the chaotic atmosphere. So could you talk a little bit about that? I mean, Cairo, for example, is a place that many people who like to travel will have visited over the years. What's the atmosphere there now?
Well, when these protests happen, they're happening right in the center of the city, the heart of the city. And so it slows down traffic. You know, it's not a war across Cairo. They're very isolated places, but it really kills traffic. There are many major hotels like the Four Seasons, like the Sheraton, the Hilton, the Intercon that are right on that path because it's on the Nile. And so recently, 2 days in a row, the Intercontinental, the Semiramis here, was raided by armed thugs and they had to shut down for a day. And when you're a tour guide operator and that's what's on the news about Cairo, how can you expect people to come?
This is NPR's Cairo bureau chief, Leila Fadel. We're talking about the ongoing protests in Egypt. You talked about the fact that the economy just seems stalled. Has President Mohamed Morsi taken any steps to try to get the economy moving again? And what have they been and what obstacles has he faced?
Well, yeah, I mean, he has. He's out there on this sort of campaign to get foreign investment. You know, he was on this trip to Germany, which wasn't particularly successful on that front. Money coming from Qatar. But the foreign reserves are dwindling. He's also negotiating for an IMF loan, but in order to get that IMF loan, he'll have to lift some of these subsidies on major things like bread, like fuel, and that won't make people happy. You know, and a lot of people look at these loans, the IMF loan, as part of the corrupt system of the old regime, the cronyism of the old regime. And so he's really been unable to pick it up so far. I mean, and I don't think, you know, he's only been in power for about 7 months, but it doesn't really matter to people who are saying, how do we eat? You know, the currency here keeps going up. The pound is devaluing, but the salaries are staying the same. So really, people can't afford anything.
I think we have another perspective that you got from a senior advisor to the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the ruling party at the moment. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, I mean, I think that there's been a struggle. The Muslim Brotherhood for so long had been a oppressed group, and now they're in power. And so Gihad al-Haddad, this senior advisor to the Muslim Brotherhood, talks about the challenges of now being in power.
We are in a situation where the heads of the state and even the heads of ministries are giving executive orders to their branches, and these orders are not being executed. It's a unique situation to be in, not entirely unexpected in a post-revolution country, and thus you cannot really apply the same rules of logic on mature democracies like the UK or the US or Europe that have gone through civil wars and 200, 300, 500, 800 years of instilling democracy and its culture in the people.
So what is he saying? Is he saying that the infrastructure of government doesn't respect the authority of the people who are now in power? They're just, what, doing their own thing?
Yeah, basically, he's saying that there is a bureaucracy in place, 7 million strong, according to him, that works in the way that it always has, infested with corruption, taking bribes, and it's not something that the president has been able to clean up in just 7 months. And he's also saying that these ministries are kind of function on their own, and so even though they've appointed new heads, they really haven't been able to get at the heart of the bureaucracy. The other thing is that the Muslim Brotherhood as an organization existed for so long as opposition, were repressed, were put in jail. The president himself was in jail under Mubarak. And so now he's the president, and suddenly these same people who were told that the Muslim Brotherhood are the boogeyman, they're going to bring down the state, they're going to turn this into, you know, Afghanistan, this kind of thing. Now he's the president and they're told respect his authority. So I think it's a really difficult position for him to be in, especially when it comes to the security sector, who were really instructed to go after these people and are now taking orders from them. So there's really been no security reform. If you look at human rights reports, there's been nothing to change these security institutions, the riot police, this kind of thing. And it's unclear if it's because of an unwillingness or an inability.
And to that end, I'm not sure everybody knows it. How many people have died since these conflicts began recently? It's something like, you know, more than 50 people. Why is that? Is it just a general chaos in the street? Is there warfare between the security forces and the people in the street? Why is the death toll so high? Do we know?
The main part of that death toll, and the numbers, depending on who you're speaking to, do vary. So some people say more than 60, some people say more than 50. Most of that comes from the canal city of Port Said, where, as you mentioned earlier, 21 soccer fans were sentenced to death over a brawl, basically, that happened out after a soccer game last year, and 74 people were killed. That city was enraged by this ruling, and they were enraged that the president told them respect the judiciary when only a couple months ago, he put himself above judicial oversight briefly to try to force the Constitution through because he said that those were corrupt courts, the top courts were corrupt courts. So they're saying, why do we have to respect the judiciary? And why are you sentencing 21 of our sons to death and no police have been held accountable for the killing of protesters, or very few? So that ended up in just like 2-3 hours on the first day when that sentence came down, 30 people were killed. And from what I understood in reporting in the town, people described it as really indiscriminate fire, but also the protesters themselves, some of them had guns and were firing back, laying siege to buildings belonging to the police or to the army due to the anger. But we didn't hear of very many police dying. Still, the state has many more weapons. And so we heard in Port Said alone, on the day that I visited on Monday, already 43 people had been killed. And after I left, another 4 were reportedly killed.
And finally, Leila, before we let you go, is there any path forward that seems promising here? Is there anybody who has the credibility to bring the sides together? Does there seem to be any kind of path forward here to stopping the violence? I'm kind of wondering in particular, with tomorrow being Friday, the day of prayer, whether that might offer some respite and give people a chance to catch their breath and take stock of the situation.
Actually, the day of prayer is the day of protest now. So every Friday brings more protest and usually an escalation in our experience here, because people will go pray in the mosque as a gathering point and then march. Mm-hmm. But I think that is the main problem, what you just touched on. Who has the credibility? And really the answer is nobody, because despite the political elites' debates amongst themselves, nobody really seems to speak for the street. So the opposition has also lost a lot of credibility. The main group, the National Salvation Front, painted this as a battle about Islamists trying to take over and make the constitution a totally Islamist constitution. And yet, yesterday they were meeting with an even more conservative group, the Noor Party, which is a Salafi group, much more conservative than the Muslim Brotherhood and much more fierce about Islamic law, against the Brotherhood. And so people are starting to say, they're not speaking for us. They're just worried about their chairs, their seats, who's going to be the president. They're not worried about our bread. So that's the thing, is there's no real leader coming forward that seems to represent Egyptians as a whole or has answers to the problems that people really want discussed, which are issues of social justice and economic equality. It's something that's really being addressed in these debates. Again, it's about things like the nature of the constitution, which of course is important for the future of Egypt, but most Egyptians are just like, what about our bread? What about that?
That was NPR Cairo Bureau Chief Leila Fadel joining us from her home base in Cairo. Leila Fadel, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Later in the program, we are going to learn what we can about a very sad story out of Chicago. An honor student who had just performed at President Obama's inauguration was shot to death this week just about a mile north of the president's Chicago home. It was apparently a case of mistaken identity. We'll try to find out more in just a few minutes. But first, more on Egypt. Since the Arab Spring protests began, we've heard a lot about how traditional players like the military and a once banned group, the Muslim Brotherhood, are shaping the country's political life now. But there's another unlikely player that we are starting to learn more about, soccer fan clubs. As we talked about earlier, violent protests have been going on in the coastal city of Port Said. This came after 21 people were sentenced to death in connection with a riot a year earlier after a soccer match in which scores of people died. Some were beaten or stabbed, but most people died of asphyxiation after they were crushed against locked stadium doors. Now, many members of these clubs, as well as their families, have been outraged by these sentences. Dave Zirin has just written about Egypt's popular soccer fan clubs and the role they are playing in what is going on in Egypt, so we have asked him to tell us more. He is, of course, a frequent participant in our Friday Barbershop Roundtable. He's sports editor of The Nation, where his piece was just published. Welcome back, Dave. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, great to be here, Michelle.
So tell us about these soccer fan clubs. I understand that they are known as ultras. They are mostly young Egyptian men. Tell us, how popular are they? How many people belong to them?
No, absolutely. I mean, ultras exist in countries all around the world. It's another name for hyper-intense fan clubs for the local soccer teams. Now, it's not uncommon in autocracies to give these ultras far more liberties in the streets of the country than others say more traditional political protesters would have. It's generally seen as something that they can blow off steam. They go in the streets, they fight the police, they fight each other, they set off fireworks. And people like Hosni Mubarak thought for decades that, well, this is fine because it's not political. Now, after Tahrir Square started to swell and build and the revolution started to build with the Arab Spring 2 years ago, The ultras found themselves in Tahrir Square, and they found themselves, to the surprise of everybody, not to themselves and to the more traditional protesters, to actually have a position of leadership inside of Tahrir Square, because they were the people who had the most experience in how to fight the state police, how to set up a checkpoint, how to secure an area, and even how to set up various pyro distractions from the state police. And they earned a great deal of respect among the more traditional reform and revolutionary forces because of their – really their endurance and willingness to fight the state police for hours on end.
And what's their role in what's going on now? We just heard from Cairo Bureau Chief Leila Fadl about the protests, and she talked a lot about how a lot of these are motivated by – just a lot of anger about the fact that people's lives have not improved. Mm-hmm. But what about these specific groups that you're talking about, the ultras? What, do they have a specific role in what's going on now?
Yes, absolutely. One of the things that's made them consistent and continual fighters over the last 2 years is that their focus has always been on the violent edge of the state apparatus of Egypt. And as your last interview made clear, that has not changed. Whether it was under Mubarak, under the military junta, and now under President Mohamed Morsi, it's the same figures as in a straight line of continuum. And over 800 people have died in the last 2 years in various protests and whatnot, and no one has had to stand trial for that. And there were a lot of hopes that after the massacre in Port Said, or sort of the soccer riot, the deaths of 74 people at the stadium in Port Said after a soccer match, that people in the state apparatus would be held to account, because it was thought by the leading political figures, by the head of the Egyptian Soccer Federation even, put out statements saying, we don't blame the soccer fans, we blame the state police, because they allowed people to be asphyxiated against the doors and against the bleachers, and it was something that got out of control. So it was widespread in Egyptian society that the fault for the 74 deaths in Port Said was with the state apparatus. And yet, when 21 people were sentenced to be hanged, not one member of the security forces or the state police were among those 21 people. So among the families and among the ultra fan clubs in Port Said for a team called Al-Masri, they have been in a state of upheaval about that. Mm-hmm. And Al-Ahli, the people whose fans were killed, at first they put out words of not celebration but just appreciation for the verdict. But that very quickly soured as they saw what was taking place around them.
I just want to play a short clip from a young Egyptian soccer fan. This is from an interview that we heard on Al Jazeera. This is from a young man named Mohamed Saad.
Ultras Ahlawi were among the first to support the revolution alongside the rest of the youth. We fought against Mubarak and then against the military. The Port Said massacre was an act of retaliation by interior ministry forces because of this.
Can you explain that, Dave Zirin, that mm-hmm. the idea that what happened to all these people was somehow retaliation for the role that these young men played in the revolution? How explain that?
Sure. Of course, what I'm about to say is both theory and conjecture, but I should make clear that this is theory and conjecture that was said by spokespeople in the Muslim Brotherhood. They were not the ruling party at the time, of course. The military was still in power. Said by every political party in Egypt, in fact, and as I said before, said by the head of the Egyptian Soccer Federation. It caused the most popular player in Egypt, a player named Mahmoud Abu Treka, to actually quit and retire from the sport. He was so disgusted by what he saw that day and what he saw the state officials do. What happened was Al-Masri won the game 3-1 against Al-Ahli, and it was considered to be an upset and very exciting. They stormed the field. They engaged in violence. There were stabbings. There were beatings. And then thousands of Al-Ahli fans attempted to flee. And you can see this on video. This is well available online, and I link to it at my article on The Nation. There is video evidence of the state police standing by idly while people are getting crushed, when they had the capacity to either open the doors or at the very least try to clear the crowds away. So they are given a lot of the blame. And so when people in Port Said see 21 people about to be hanged to death because of what took place, you'd see the state not be called into account. It raises then a ton of other issues. It becomes a Pandora's box for all the ways that there hasn't been justice in the last 2 years in instances of state violence.
Okay, very briefly, Dave Zirin, What, to the degree that you can determine this, what is the how are these current protests affecting the people's attitude about the soccer clubs? Because as you were, as you indicated earlier, they got a lot of respect for their endurance, for their smarts, for their kind of tactical skill, if you want to call it that, during the Arab Spring protests. What about now? How are they being viewed now in the wake of this?
Well, they're being viewed as being the most courageous and consistent fighters against a regime that is growing in unpopularity. And this is very interesting because certainly people don't associate sports fandom with these kinds of street actions.
Dave Zirin is sports editor of The Nation. He's host of SiriusXM's Edge of Sports, and he was kind enough to join us today from NPR's Bureau in New York. Dave Zirin, thank you for joining us.
Well, my privilege, Michelle.
We turn now to an all-too-familiar story of violence here in the U.S. In Chicago, 15-year-old honor student Hadiyah Pendleton was shot and killed on Tuesday. She was the 42nd person killed in Chicago since the beginning of the year. Last year, there were more than 500 killings, and a number of these murders, particularly of young people, brought the city to tears. But Pendleton's death has brought national attention because she recently performed with her high school drill team at the president's inauguration in Washington, D.C. According to the authorities, she had taken shelter from a rainstorm along with several friends when a gunman sprayed the group with bullets. Her mother, Cleopatra Pendleton, told a local reporter she had a message for the gunman.
Shame on you. Shame on you. Really? Like, what were you thinking? These are just children.
Joining us now to tell us more is Mary Mitchell. She is an award-winning columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. Welcome back to the program, Mary. I'm so sorry for the reason that brings us together today.
Thank you very much for the invitation. And you're right, it's such a tragedy, and we hear it all too often in Chicago.
What do we know now, or what do the authorities know now about the circumstances that led to Hadiyah Pendleton's death? As I understand it, the current thinking is that this was a case of mistaken identity, that the gunman for some reason thought the group of people she was with were people with whom he had some sort of altercation. I understand that two other young men were shot the same day, but their injuries were not life-threatening. What else do we know?
Correct. Well, what we know is that, first of all, it was erroneously reported that the group of students were gang-related in some way, that some of them were gang members. That is not correct. These were young people who had finished taking a final exam at a selective enrollment school, King College Prep, and they were in a park on a 60-degree weather day in Chicago. They were teens, 15, 16-year-olds. A man jumped the fence and ran toward them, firing 5 shots. This is what I'm told. 3 people were wounded, and of course, Adia was killed. So the idea that it's mistaken identity, that's what they're saying now. I mean, really, it's mistaken identity that a gathering of young people can't be in a park without without a alleged gang member or someone, an alleged shooter, coming at them. And that's what we're dealing with, the fact that some of these young people are armed, they are callous, they are ruthless, and they are openly, in broad daylight, willing to run and attack people they don't even know.
And as you know, we mentioned, just to point out, this was in 2:20 in the afternoon.
Right. And I think part of this conversation has to be the fact that in that community, although it is about a mile from President Barack Obama's Chicago home, that's a gentrifying community. Brownstones, graystones, a lot of construction of moderate income housing and mixed community housing. So low income people have been literally pushed out of that community. And the thought is that the ones that maybe some gang members that have remained are trying to claim that territory and sell a group of young people and thinking that they may have been rivals.
You know, this comes at a very kind of poignant moment in our national history. You know, of course, in December, there was this terrible shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, where 20 children lost their lives at an elementary school, along with 6 adults. And just yesterday, there were hearings on the Hill about on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., about, you know, various legislative kind of frameworks for addressing this. Former Congresswoman, who's also a gun violence survivor, Gabrielle Giffords, was among those calling for more strict gun laws. And Pendleton says, as you might imagine, brought attention from the White House as well. I'll just play a short clip from a press briefing on Wednesday where the presidential spokesman, Jay Carney, offered the first family's condolences and that said that President Obama was focused on this. Here is a clip.
the president has more than once when he talks about gun violence in America, referred not just to the horror of Newtown or Aurora or Virginia Tech or Oak Creek, but to shootings on the corner in Chicago or other parts of the country. And this is just another example of the problem that we need to deal with.
Mary Mitchell, I wanted to ask, how are the people who write to you, your readers, other people you talk to in the city, how are they responding to all this? Do they feel that their national leaders are paying enough attention to what's happening in Chicago and some other places around the country? And how do they feel about the attention being focused on gun violence now?
Well, they're usually, when I hear from people, their concern is that it takes a mass murder like what happened in Newtown, Connecticut, to bring and focus attention on a problem that Chicago and a lot of urban areas have been dealing with for years. This story, Hadiya's story, has been told over and over again in Chicago. It was the story of a 7-year-old Heaven Sutton, who was selling candy in front of our house and was killed. It's the story of Blair Holt, who was riding a bus on his way from school and threw himself in front of a friend and died because a shooter got on the bus. So the concern here is that it takes, you know, the murder of someone like Adia, who is an honor student and who performed at the inaugural festivities a week ago, to focus attention when really children are being killed every day. So they want the strengthening of gun laws, but they also want the gun laws that's already on the books to be enforced. Illegal gun possession, in most cases, a first-time offense is a misdemeanor. That's not right. The fact of the matter is that, you know, police, when they arrive on the scene, they arrive too late. The deed has already been done. So they want more police presence. And to his credit, Mayor Rahm Emanuel seems to be hearing that message, because he is now announcing that he's going to reassign 200 police officers who are on desk duty to the streets. They need more patrol in these neighborhoods and more people to get involved and really helping to try to solve the problem of youth with nothing to do except stand on the corners and sell drugs.
You know, we've reported and we've talked to you many times over the last, you know, couple of years about the sort of dramatic steps that some figures in Chicago have been taking to try to draw attention to this. Do people feel that the rest of the country cares?
Yes. I think that when you have a tragic story like this, and our focus is on the fact that this was a brilliant, good girl, and that she could die on a beautiful, a warm day in Chicago for no other reason than she was at a park, I think that that really gets to the emotions of people, and they want something done about it. They want more protection in these communities, and they want more attention paid to really the kind of conditions that lead people to be involved in activities that can put them on the path to pulling a gun and shooting indiscriminately in a crowd.
Mary Mitchell is a columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. She joined us from member station WBEZ in Chicago. Mary Mitchell, we've talked about this too many times. I fear this won't be the last time. But I thank you so much for speaking with us about this important story, and please do keep us informed.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Later in the program, we will pay tribute to the late Leroy Sugarfoot Bonner, the leader of the funk band The Ohio Players, died earlier this week at the age of 69, and we will tell you more about him in a few minutes. But first, it is Oscar season, and movie fans are debating the merits of lavish big-budget productions like Les Mis or gritty ripped-from-the-headlines features like Zero Dark Thirty. But there's another genre of film that often gets less attention but can sometimes have more lasting impact. We're talking about documentaries, and those two worlds of film are coming together in a documentary series about life, art, and pop culture in the African diaspora. The series is called called Afropop, The Ultimate Cultural Exchange. The fifth season premiered last week on Public Television's World Channel, and it is hosted by none other than Oscar and Golden Globe nominee Gabourey Sidibe. You probably remember her from her star-making turn as Precious in the Lee Daniels film by the same name, and Gabourey Sidibe is with us now.
Thank you so much for having me.
What made you want to host this series?
Well, it's one, it's in its fifth season, and every season they have a different host. And I guess they sort of go for people that are sort of Afrocentric. You know, Idris Elba and Anika Noni Rose. And I actually am half Senegalese. And so any chance that I can express my African side, I sort of jump at the chance to. And I saw this as a great opportunity to sort of be more African, I guess, and to make my dad proud.
Your dad was from Senegal, correct?
Yes.
Did you feel a connection with the culture when you were growing up? I mean, did he have an opportunity to introduce it to you?
Absolutely. I grew up celebrating Senegalese holidays and, you know, like Ramadan and Tabaski and all these different holidays that we that my dad grew up celebrating. And, you know, my dad's like Muslim, but because that's part of his heritage and part of his culture. And so I got to see what that was like. And yeah, I did. It definitely wasn't in the back burner of who I was. It sort of was at the front of who I was as a child.
And also with your name. I mean, your name is a name that people will ask you about. They will ask, gee, what's the origin of your name or what's the heritage of your name? Were you asked this growing up?
Yeah, a lot. Well, my last name, Sidibe, is actually from Mali. But it's sort of like Johnson in Mali and in Senegal, too. And so, yeah, I did get a lot of questions about my name. And I've always thought my name was really special, and I was always really excited to have it. My middle name is Malinger, which translates to my queen, which my mom, growing up, my mom told me that Gabourey, my first name, meant daughter of the queen, which spoke more about her than it did about me. But it wasn't until I was like 24 and I asked my dad if that was true, and he told me no, that he doesn't really know the meaning of Gabourey, but Malinger means my queen, and it's a statement about how he feels about me.
Oh,
well, isn't that sweet?
That is sweet. So my queen, thank you. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with my queen, Oscar and Golden Globe nominated actress Gabourey Sidibe. She's best known for her lead role in the 2009 drama Precious, based on the novel Push by Sapphire. We are talking about a new season of the series Afropop. It's presenting films about the African diaspora. You know, that whole question of identity is central to one of the films in the series. It's a lot like you. It's by filmmaker Eliaichi Kimaro, and it was part of the it was first presented as part of the Asian American International Film Festival. She's a first generation American with a Tanzanian father and a Korean mother, and then they moved back to Tanzania after they retired, and she kind of went digging into the family story and it found some things out that were a little hard to take. For example, realizing that many of her aunts had been victims of sexual violence. I just want to play, I think we have a short clip from the film. Let's play it.
I never felt like I truly belonged with either the Korean community or my African American friends, and especially not with the Chaga side of my family. Every summer in Tanzania was a reminder that this kinship I bragged about to my American friends existed only in my imagination. My whole goal with this film was to try to understand the cultural roots of my blackness, and maybe in the process, find that sense of belonging I fantasized about as a kid.
What did you like about this film? What do you hope people draw from it?
I really love the idea that this woman sort of, in the beginning of the film, she said that she sort of would lord this idea that she was African over some of the people that she grew up with. And going back as an adult, she found that she actually wasn't as African on the inside as she thought she was. And that really spoke to me, because I did the same thing, you know? I always thought I was sort of not better than, you know, the kids I grew up with, but sort of just different and a little bit more special because I had this African side to me. And growing up, I realized that I probably know less about it than I thought well, I absolutely know less about being African than I thought. And so that part really spoke to me.
What about some of the other films? As I mentioned, there are a number of films in this series. And I just want to mention here that although you want to check your local listings for exact times, the fifth season premiered last week on Public Television's World Channel, and it runs every Tuesday through February 5th. What are some of the other films in this series that you particularly liked?
My favorite film was Stolen. There's a program that the UN has to reunite families that were torn apart and put into refugee camps. And so that's what the filmmakers thought they were doing. That's the movie they thought they were making in the beginning. But once they reunite the family, they find that the mother is still a slave and that she's enslaved at that moment. And everyone's denying the fact that there's still slavery happening, and they're so ashamed of it, and they're lying about it, but it's very clear. And so it, like, sort of becomes almost a thriller where they get their tape taken away from them, and it's like the government's now involved, and they have to fight to get their tape back. And then the woman who is enslaved, who was talking about it, is now denying that she's enslaved. And it sort of just becomes a big thriller. It was really, really interesting and kept me on the edge of my seat.
Yeah, I agree with you. And there is an element in a number of these films of airing dirty laundry. Mm-hmm. I mean, and to a purpose, not just gratuitously, but, you know, just basically talking about some hard things that people need to talk about. By way of connection, you know, that was also one of the hard conversations that a lot of people had around Precious. I mean, that was a hard film for a lot of people to take. Frankly, it was hard to watch. I just wanted to ask, since this is the first chance I've had to talk with you about it, what was that experience like, you know, for you? I mean, the whole story of how you got that role is fascinating in and of itself. You'd never acted before.
No.
Right? That's true, right? You had never acted before.
Yeah, no, I just did college theater, which certainly doesn't compare to films. No, it was absolutely my first audition.
Very provocative film, very controversial. What are your thoughts about it now that you've had a couple years distance from it?
Well, I was a fan of the book. It was adapted from the novel Push by Sapphire. And I thought, in reading the book, I thought, how true. How gritty and real. I've grown up with girls that are like Precious. I've grown up with people that are like everyone that I read about in that book. And so years later, when I was given the role, I just felt a huge responsibility to show the reality of that situation and to show that we're not making it up. While Precious isn't a real person, it's someone's story. And it's too many people's stories.
Let me play a short clip for people who may not remember the film. This is, again, from Lee Daniels' 2009 drama, Precious, and Gebere plays the title role. Here she is.
My name, Clarice Precious Jones. I go by Precious. I live in Harlem. I like yellow. And I had problems at my other school, so I come here.
You know, anybody listening to that clip and listening to how you really speak, what a transformation that was. Because you are not at all the kind of dour, you know, obviously the course of the movie, in the course of the book, the Precious undergoes a transformation, which is, in fact, you know, quite beautiful. But that was not you at all. How did you get into that headspace? How did you get into that place?
Well, like I said, I've grown up with girls like Precious. And at some point in my life, I was Precious myself. So she was so familiar to me that it was just about sort of imitating parts of myself and imitating people that I've grown up with.
What do you mean by that was you at one point? What do you mean by that?
Well, I've certainly have been sort of, you know, Precious has a lot of self-esteem issues. And, she's got a lot of problems and she's very much down. And, you know, I was a teenager once and I felt down and I felt bad about myself. And so it was just sort of about channeling that part of me, that part of my past.
I don't know if this is true, but it's been reported that the actress Joan Cusack reportedly advised you to stop acting, thinking that you wouldn't be able to get enough roles to make a living. Is that true? Did she really say that to you?
It sounds much worse than what happened. We met at a party, and it was right before Precious came out, and so I wasn't a known actress or anything like that. And she just wanted to give me advice, and it actually came from a very sweet place, you know. While she might have been wrong, she definitely wasn't trying to hurt me or to, you know, she really wanted to be nice, I think. And she was trying to shield me from the heartbreak that comes along with chasing an acting career.
What would you say to her now?
This pretty much the same thing I said to her then. I just, you know, said, well, you know, I am really busy, which I still sort of am. I'm still an actress. And to be fair, a lot of people thought that I wasn't going to be an actress after that movie or at all, really. And so it's sort of fun to make people wrong.
Okay. Well, how are you doing now? Congratulations on everything so far. What's next for you?
Well, I just, I am on the Big C, a Showtime series. We just wrapped our series. We did 4 seasons and we just finished it. We just finished in December. And right after, I did a Greg Araki film that should be out. Oh, I don't know, but it's called A White Bird in a Blizzard. I'm really, really excited about that. I have 2 more films coming up this year. And yeah, I'm a little busy, but I'm also sort of on a break right now.
Will you, as a former nominee, go to any of the events in the Oscar season?
I don't know. Well, one of my favorite, my favorite event to go to is Alfrey Woodard has a party that I call the Blacktress Party. It's like black actresses that either have been nominated for an Oscar or should have been. And it sort of is just a night where we all get in the room and we get to celebrate each other. And you know, there's not a lot of press there or anything. It's just actresses. It's so amazing because this work is sort of, you know, it's solitary. You do a lot of your work sort of alone, even though you have castmates and things like that. You're still sort of alone. And so it's nice to sit in a room with like-minded people who also feel alone. And in this moment, we know that we're not. And that we all sort of, even if we're on set by ourselves, we join hands.
Thank you for that. Thank you for telling us about that. And I assume you have, of course, a fabulous dress.
Getting a dress is so nerve-wracking. I don't have a dress yet, so I'm not sure. I'm not sure if I want to put the attention into getting a dress so that I can go to the Oscars. Maybe I'll go to one of the after parties and I'll just show up in, I don't know, leggings and a top.
Well, whatever you wear, I'm sure it'll be fabulous. Well, keep us posted on whatever you decide to do next.
Okay, thank
now
you.
That we know the true meaning of your name, the Queen. Gaboré Sidibé is an Oscar-nominated, Golden Globe-nominated actress. She is hosting the new public television series Afro Pop. It's in its 5th season. It runs every Tuesday through February 5th. You'll want to check your local listings for exact times on public television. And she was kind enough to join us from our bureau in New York. Gaboré Sidibé, my queen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And now we'd like to remember a funk legend. Leroy Bonner died last weekend at the age of 69. Best known as the frontman for the Ohio Players, Sugarfoot as he was called, joined the band in 1964 as guitarist, songwriter, and eventually lead singer. He was the eldest of 14 kids, and he was a self-taught musician who never went to high school. Scholar Scott Brown of UCLA spent time with the late musician when he was researching a book about funk music with roots in Ohio.
For all of the largesse of his personality on stage and as a character and as a musician, if you met him one-on-one, he was a very quiet, thoughtful, reflective, and very philosophical person.
Professor Brown says Sugarfoot redefined funk by bringing a country blues sensibility.
Sugar has that understanding of tone. He has a tone that you know that Sugarfoot when he's singing. There's a soulfulness there. All of the kind of anguish and satire of the blues vocalist is in Sugar's voice.
The Ohio Players thrived in the 1970s, producing 7 top 40 hits with their distinctive brand of funk and soul. And while they never won a Grammy for their music, the Ohio Players took one home for Best Album Package in 1976 for the album Honey, which, like many of their other covers, featured provocative images of African-American women. Ricky Vincent, author of Funk, The Music, The People, and The Rhythm of the One, says Sugarfoot's contribution to funk was unparalleled, including his distinctive style.
Sugarfoot was a mind blower because he had the little sparkle in his teeth, and then he had this amazing double neck guitar, and then he had this afro that was kind of permed and laid off to the side a little bit. And so he was in a sort of a permanent lean when you checked him out. And so you just knew this was, you know, the player among the players.
Here's a clip of an interview that he did with Houston DJ Mad Hatta on his own musical legacy.
To make music that lasts is more important than making a hit that just goes out there and ends up nobody remembering you no more in life. To be immortal is my desire.
Leroy Sugarfoot Bonner of the Ohio Players, he died last weekend at the age of 69.
You know what I think heaven is? I think heaven is you. You know that?
And that's our program for today. Tell Me More is produced by Bridget Armstrong, Freddie Boswell, Bridget Deshagas, Andrew Limbong, Sinaj Meshkinpour, Emily Oxenschlager, Amitha Parasha, Chiquita Pascal, and Amy Ta. Our intern is Matt Reeves. Our editor is Ahmad Omar. Our special thanks to NPR's librarians. Our director is Arjun Hutchins. Our senior producer is Devar Ardalan. The technical director is Neil Tivault, with audio engineers Sean Phillips, Kurt Stalniker, and Brian Jarbo. Our theme music was composed by Underdog Entertainment, with additional arrangements by Ian Honeyman. Our senior editors are Ann Hawk and Alicia Montgomery. Our acting executive producer is Carlene Watson. Remember to tell us more. Please go to npr.org and find us under the Programs tab. You can find our podcast there. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter. The handle is @TellMeMoreNPR. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Let's talk more tomorrow. A glass of lemonade.